are the people that were jerky to you? If the answer is yes, you have a more difficult road ahead of you. I suggest that you model your strategy after the old Sesame Street film piece, Over, Under, Through. If you're under 40, you might not remember this film. It taught the concepts of over, under, and through by filming toddlers crawling through an abandoned construction site. They don't show it anymore because someone has since realized that that's nuts. If your boss is a jerk, try to find someone above or around your boss who is not a jerk. Is there such a thing as an all-jerk workplace? Yes. I would flat out avoid working with Wall Street traders or the women who run the changing rooms at Filene's basement. If you're lucky, your workplace will have a neutral proving ground, like the rifle range or the car sales total board or the SNL read-through. If so, focus on that. Again, don't waste your energy trying to educate or change opinions. Go over, under, through, and opinions will change organically when you are the boss. Or they won't. Who cares? Do your thing. Don't care if they like it. Amazing. Gorgeous. Not like that. People sometimes ask me, what's it like to do photo shoots for magazines? Do you enjoy that kind of thing? And let me be completely honest here. Publicity and press junkets are just part of the job. Your work is what you really care about because your work is your craft and your craft is your art. And photo shoots are the funnest. In case you ever find yourself at a magazine cover shoot, and you might, because Snooki and I have, so anything can happen, let me tell you what to expect. It's usually in some cool place called White, or Smash House, or Jinx Studios. Sometimes it's at an amazing hotel. Wherever it is, it's nicer than where you had your wedding. You take a freight elevator up to a beautiful loft where there is a coffee bar at which everything is free. Free, I say! I suggest you show up freshly scrubbed with damp hair. Not only is this a courtesy to your hair and makeup team, but it also helps to set the bar low. Show up looking like an uncooked chicken leg, and they can't help but be pleased with the transformation once they've got all their makeup on you. I think this is what Jesse Jackson calls the subtle genius of lowered expectations, but I may be misquoting. You'll be introduced to the stylist and shown racks and racks of clothes. She has been given your sizes ahead of time and has chosen to ignore them. All the shoes will be too big, and all the pants and skirts will be a 5T. The stylists like to figure out a few looks before hair and makeup begins, so you will try on 20 or 30 things. Somebody will put up a makeshift wall by holding a full-length mirror next to an open loft window, and you will strip down naked. You must not look in that mirror at your doughy legs and flat feet, for today is about dreams and illusions, and unfiltered natural daylight is the enemy of dreams. When you inevitably can't fit into a garment, the stylist's assistant will be sent in to help you. The stylist's assistant will be a chic 20-year-old Asian girl named Esther, or Agnes, or Lot's wife. In a few years, she'll be running the editorial staff, but at this point in time, her job is to stuff a middle-aged woman's bare ass crack into a Prada dress and zip it up. In my case, Esther and I are always mutually frustrated when zipping up the tiny dress. Esther is disgusted by my dimply flesh and her low status. I'm annoyed that her tiny hands lack the strength to get Pandora's plague back into the box. "How's it going in there?" calls the stylist passive-aggressively. Reinforcements are called in to push on both sides of my rib cage until the zipper goes up. To avoid conflict, we all blame a third party. "It's these damn invisible zippers," we all say in unison. I don't know why designers use them. The reason none of the dresses fit is because they are samples. They are from the runway, and they were made to fit runway models. Sometimes I can actually fit in a sample size because at 5'4", I have the waist size of a 7-foot model. "You can fit in a sample size," they tell me triumphantly, with the dress straining at the seams, 2 feet too long at the bottom and the bra cups hanging right above my navel. They want this to be important to you, so go with it. Next, you are taken to the hair and makeup chair. "Do you have anything on your face?" the makeup artist will ask gently. You don't, because, as previously mentioned, you are sandbagging. The makeup artist will then delicately apply expensive moisturizer to your chicken leg while the hairstylist massages your scalp, secretly checking for bald spots. Once you're moisturized and have enjoyed your free cappuccino, the makeup transformation begins in earnest. They pluck your eyebrows for what seems like 20 minutes, even though you have already fully plucked them the night before. If you're like me, you probably take 10 to 12 seconds a day to put on some eyeliner and mascara. Maybe you throw in 5 seconds of eyeshadow if it's New Year's Eve. The makeup artist at your photo shoot will work methodically on your eyelids with a series of tickly little brushes for 100 minutes. It's soothing, actually, because you must sit still and you absolutely can't do anything else. She'll do this thing before she lines your lips where she puts her finger on your top lip and rolls it back ever so gently. When she is done, you look like you have lips. Not crazy overdrawn grandma lips like you would do, but God-given lips. While this is going on, someone gives you a manicure and a pedicure. At really fancy photo shoots, a celebrity fecalist will study your bowel movements and adjust your humors. The leg massage and the warm lights of the makeup mirror feel so cozy that you could almost believe that this is your actual life instead of that endless degrading looking for the checkbook and boiling macaroni shit you live with at home. At some point in the morning, one of the stylists or publicists or fecalists will declare that the free coffee is, it's not working for me. And some intern is sent out to get other coffee or bubble tea or gum, Advil, Red Bull, and egg white omelets that are destined to be forgotten about and left on a windowsill. Only when your makeup is done will they start to do your hair. Your hair will be blown straight, then set on large rollers. The hairdresser's assistant hands him rollers and pins on command like an OR nurse. These fashionable young assistants are a fun window into what the rest of us will be wearing 3 years from now. From what I've seen lately, we can look forward to the return of prairie skirts and the male shag. The prairie skirts will be on men and the male shag will be on women. Once your hair is straightened, it will be curled, then shown to the photographer who will stare at it with his or her head cocked to one side. Then it will be re-straightened. Depending on the concept for the shoot and the health of your natural hair, you may be asked to wear hair extensions. It's okay. A controlled photo shoot environment is where extensions belong. Places that are less ideal for hair extensions, the grocery store, women's prison, a water park. Once your hair and makeup are done, you'll slip into your first look. It will most definitely be one of the dresses that didn't even come close to fitting, so Lot's wife will bridge the gap with a thick piece of white elastic and some safety pins. Don't ever feel inadequate when you look at magazines. Just remember that every person you see on a cover has a bra and underwear hanging out a gaping hole in the back. Everyone. Heidi Klum, the Olsen twins, David Beckham, everybody. Et voila. Just 2 to 3 hours after your arrival, you are ready to be taken to the photographer and shot. There are different types of fancy photographers. Some are big, fun personalities like Mario Testino, who once told me, "Lift your chin, darling. You are not 18." I enjoyed his honesty. Also, I'm pretty sure he says that to models who are 19. Some photographers plan out every detail of the shot, then plug you into it. For example, with Annie Leibovitz, you might have advanced fittings for several custom Tinkerbell costumes. On the day of the shoot, Annie will pick one of the costumes, then obscure it with a large harness. Afterwards, she'll remove the harness with Photoshop, change the color of the costume, and shrink you down to the size of a pea anyway. There are the nonchalant, cool guy photographers who shoot for Rolling Stone and GQ. Watch out for these guys, because their offhand manner can trick you, and the next thing you know, you're posing with your pants off. Or worse, with your shoes off. I'm a firm believer in our constitutional right to wear shoes, and I believe more people should take advantage of it. I never go barefoot during a photo shoot. Even if they say your feet are out of frame, don't believe them. I know what you're thinking, and no, I don't have horrible, messed up feet. Maybe my feet are so amazing that I want to shelter them so they can live a normal life. I don't want them to be the Surrey Cruise of feet. Did you ever think about that? The photographer will ask you what kind of music you want to play during the shoot. Remember that whatever you choose will be blasted through the loft and heard by an entire crew of people who are all so cool that the Board of Ed officially closed school. Just murmur hip-hop or make up the name of a hipster-sounding band and then act superior when they've never heard of it. Do you guys have any Asphalt of Pinking? Really? Whatever you want, then. Sometimes they ask you if you want to hook up your iPod for background music. Do not do this. It's a trap. They'll put it on shuffle, and no matter how much Beastie Boys or Velvet Underground you have on there, the following 4 tracks will play in a row. We'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover from Annie, Hold On by Wilson Phillips, That's What Friends Are For, various artists, and we'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover, from Annie. To get through the actual shooting process, there are 3 skills you need to master. 1. Posing. Posing for a successful glamour portrait is very simple. Start with the basics. Turn sideways. Lean back against a wall. Move your chin forward to elongate your neck. Relax your shoulders, make angles wherever possible. If you're over 24, smile at all times. Keep your arms slightly away from your side so as not to smush them and make them look larger. Suck your stomach up and in and wrap your buttocks toward the back Pilates style. Be yourself. When you look into the lens, imagine you are looking at a dear friend, but not a friend who would laugh at you for jutting out your chin while arching your back against a fake wall. Know your weaknesses. For example, I have what can be described as dead shark eyes. But if I try too hard to look alert, I look batshit crazy like the runaway bride. If a bout of creepy face sets in, the trick is to look away from the camera between shots and turn back only when necessary. This also limits how much of your soul the camera can steal. Skill number 2, dealing with what is being said to you. Most photographers have some kind of verbal patter going on when they shoot. Great, turn to me, big smile, less shark eyes, have fun with it, not like that. Some photographers are completely effusive. Beautiful, amazing, gorgeous, oh, so gorgeous, they yell at shutter speed. If you are anything less than insane, you will realize that this is not sincere. It's hard to take because it's more positive feedback than you've received in your entire life thrown at you in 15 seconds. It would be like going jogging while someone rode next to you in a slow-moving car yelling, "Yes, you are Carl Lewis. You are breaking a world record right now. Amazing. You are fast. You are going very fast. Yes." With the wind blowing on your long extensions, you feel like Beyoncé. The moment the wind machine stops, you catch a glimpse of yourself in the mirror and wonder, "Why is the mother from Coal Miner's Daughter here?" Your impulse will be to wilt with embarrassment. Do not. Before you look up for that bucket of pig's blood, remember, your third and most difficult task is trying to enjoy it. Task number 3, trying to enjoy it. Proceed as if you look awesome. This requires a level of delusion slash egomania usually reserved for popes and drag queens, but you can do it. It's like being a little kid again, parading around in a nightgown tucked into your underpants, believing it looks terrific. Your right mind knows that you look ridiculous in a half-open dress and giant shoes, but you must put yourself back in third grade, slipping on your mom's quilted caftan and drinking cream soda out of a champagne glass while watching The Love Boat. You have never been more glamorous. As Mario Testino might say to a shark, tense-eyed 40-year-old, "Believe you are worthy of the cover." After about 17 minutes of shooting, they call lunch. The catered lunch makes you feel like you are finally the person you always wanted to be. Vegetable tartlets, arugula salad with figs, quinoa, fish that is somehow more flavorful and delicious than a Wendy's hamburger, miniature lemon meringue pies, hibiscus iced tea. You fantasize about how wonderful your life would be if you had this food delivered every day. Oh, the energy you would have! Your stools would be museum quality. You could finally impress the fecalist. At some point, someone from your real job or home life will call to check in. Pretend you're exhausted and that this whole photo shoot thing is a big inconvenience. Say you'll be done by 6 and that you'll be sure to get home in time to help organize the basement storage unit. And then hang up. Do not let those people kill your buzz. Your afternoon will fly by as you get more and more confident posing like an old Virginia Slims ad. And then you're done. You get back into this morning's sweatpants, brush out your hair, which by now looks like you've been standing on a tarmac all day, and that's it. You don't get to keep the clothes, by the way. Some people say that the really famous people get to keep the clothes, but I suspect it's just the pushiest, most deluded people who get to keep the clothes, because they steal them and no one says anything. Your only keepsakes are the individual false eyelashes that you later find stuck to your boob in the shower. Someone should do a study of the human brain and how quickly it can adjust to luxury. You could take a homeless person who has been living on the street for 20 years, and if you let them do 3 magazine photo shoots, by the 4th one, they would be saying, "Oh, Louboutins really don't work on me. Can I try the Roger Vivier?" By the 5th one, they'd sigh, "Oh, do they not have the vegetable tartlets? Bummer." In a passive-aggressive tone that means, "Somebody go get them." You may sink into a depression over the next 36 hours. You may wonder why your loved ones don't call out, "Amazing, gorgeous, write to me," as you scramble their eggs. But just be patient, because in a few weeks the magazine will be out, and you will have incontrovertible proof that you are a young Catherine Deneuve. You casually check the newsstand on your way to buy Ben Gay heating pads. One day, there it is. Right between Jessica Simpson and those people from The Bachelor who murdered each other. It's your face. It is your face, right? You can barely recognize yourself with the amount of digital correction. They've taken out your knuckles and given you baby hands. The muscular calves that you're generally very proud of are slimmed to the bone. And what's with the eyes? They always get it wrong under the eyes. In an effort to remove dark circles, they take out any depth, and your face looks like it was drawn on a paper plate. You looked forward to them taking out your chickenpox scars and your broken blood vessels, but how do you feel when they erase part of you that is perfectly good? We have now entered the debate over America's most serious and pressing issue, Photoshop. A lot of women are outraged by the use of Photoshop in magazine photos. I say a lot of women because I have yet to meet one man who could give a fat turd about the topic, not even a gay man. I feel about Photoshop the way some people feel about abortion. It is appalling and a tragic reflection on the moral decay of our society, unless I need it, in which case, everybody be cool. Do I think Photoshop is being used excessively? Yes. I saw Madonna's Louis Vuitton ad, and honestly, at first glance, I thought it was Gwen Stefani's baby. Do I worry about overly retouched photos giving women unrealistic expectations and body image issues? I do. I think that we will soon see a rise in anorexia in women over 70. Because only people over 70 are fooled by Photoshop. Only your great aunt forwards you an image of Sarah Palin holding a rifle wearing an American flag bikini and thinks it's real. Only your Uncle Vic sends a photo of Barack Obama wearing a hammer and sickle t-shirt and has to have it explained to him that somebody faked that with the computer. People have learned how to spot it, just like everyone learned how to spot fake boobs. Look for the upper arm meat. If there's no upper arm meat, the breasts are fake. Unlike breast implants, which can mess up your health, digital retouching is relatively harmless. As long as we all know it's fake, it's no more dangerous to society than a radio broadcast of the War of the Worlds. Photoshop is just like makeup. When it's done well, it looks great, and when it's overdone, you look like a crazy asshole. Unfortunately, most people don't do it well. I find the fancier the fashion magazine is, the worse the Photoshop. It's as if they're already so disgusted that a human has to be in the clothes, they can't stop erasing human features. Why can't we accept the human form as it is? Screams no one. I don't know why, but we never have. That's why people wore corsets and neck stretchers and powdered wigs. If you're going to expend energy being mad about Photoshop, you're also going to have to be mad about earrings. No one's ears are that sparkly. They shouldn't have to be. You'll have to get mad about oil paintings. Those people didn't really look like that. I, for one, am furious that people are allowed to turn sideways in photographs. Why can't we accept a woman's full width? I won't rest until people are only allowed to be photographed facing front under a fluorescent light. It should absolutely be mandatory for magazines to credit the person who performed the Photoshop work. Just like they do the makeup artist and the stylist, in very tiny white print, on white paper. Some people say it's a feminist issue. I agree, because the best Photoshop job I ever got was for a feminist magazine called Bust in 2004. It was a low-budget shoot in the back of their downtown office. There was no free coffee bar or wind machine, just a bunch of intelligent women with a sense of humor. I looked at the two paltry lights they had set up and turned to the editors. We're all feminists here, but you guys are going to use Photoshop, right? Oh, yeah, they all replied instantly. Feminists do the best Photoshop because they leave the meat on your bones. They don't change your size or your skin color. They leave in your disgusting knuckles, but you know, they may take out some armpit stubble. Not because they're denying its existence, but because they understand that it's okay to make a photo look as if you were caught on your best day in the best light. In an amazing act of bravery, I will let you see this photo of me with Photoshop and without. Please check your PDF. There are 7 differences. See if you can spot them. Nose thinned, glasses made smaller, forehead moon map removed, eyebrows added, teeth elongated, pearls de-oldified, West Hayes tidy whitey sports poster removed. Photoshop itself is not evil, just like Italian salad dressing is not inherently evil until you rub it all over a desperate young actress and stick her on the cover of Maxim pretending to pull her panties down. That thumbs in the panties move is the worst. Really? It's not enough that they got greased up in their panties for you, Maxim? They gotta pretend to pull them down? I say give it up. Retouching is here to stay. Technology doesn't move backwards. No society has ever deindustrialized, which is why we'll never turn back from Photoshop, and why the economic collapse of China is going to be the death of us all. Never mind that. Let's keep being up in arms about this Photoshop business. I don't see a future in which we're all anorexic and suicidal. I do see a future in which we all retouch the bejesus out of our own pictures at home. Family Christmas cards will just be eyes and nostrils in a snowman border. At least with Photoshop, you don't really have to alter your body. It's better than all these disgusting injectables and implants. Isn't it better to have a computer do it to your picture than to have a doctor do it to your face? I have thus far refused to get any Botox or plastic surgery, although I do wear a clear elastic chin strap that I hook around my ears and pin under my day wig. I can't be expected to lead the charge on everything. Let me have my Photoshop, for today is about dreams. Dear Internet, one of my greatest regrets, other than being the Zodiac Killer, I mean, never learning to tango, is that I don't always have time to answer the wonderful correspondence I receive. When people care enough to write, the only well-mannered thing to do is to return the gift. So please indulge me while I answer some fans here. This is from TMZ.com, posted by Sonia in TX at 4:33 p.m. on April 7th, 2010. When is Tina going to do something about that hideous scar across her cheek? Dear Sonia in TX, greetings, Texan friend. I'm assuming the TX in your name stands for Texas and not some rare chromosomal deficiency you have. I hope I'm right about that. First of all, my apologies for the delayed response. I was unaware you had written until I went on TMZ.com to watch some of their amazing footage of people in L.A. leaving restaurants, and I stumbled upon your question. I'm sure if you and I compare schedules, we could find a time to get together and do something about this scar of mine. But the trickier question is, what am I going to do? I would love to get your advice, actually. I'm assuming you're a physician because you seem really knowledgeable about how the human body works. What do you think I should do about this hideous scar? I guess I could wear a bag on my head, but do I go with linen like the Elephant Man or a simple brown paper like the Unknown Comic? Oh, too many choices. Help. Thank you for your time. You are a credit to Texas and Viking women both. Yours, Tina. P.S. Great use of double question marks, by the way. It makes you seem young. From delisted.com, submitted by Centaurus on Monday, September 21st, 2009, 2:08 a.m. Tina Fey is an ugly, pear-shaped, bitchy, overrated troll. Dear Centaurus, first, let me say how inspiring it is that you have learned to use a computer. I hate for our correspondence to be confrontational, but you have offended me deeply. To say I'm an overrated troll when you have never seen me guard a bridge is patently unfair. I'll leave it for others to say if I'm the best, but I am certainly one of the most dedicated trolls guarding bridges today. I always ask three questions, and at least two of them are riddles. As for ugly, pear-shaped, and bitchy, I prefer the terms offbeat, business class assed, and exhausted. But I'll take what I can get. There's no such thing as bad press. Now go to bed, you crazy night owl. You have to be at NASA early in the morning so they can look for your penis with the Hubble telescope. Affectionately, Tina. From PerezHilton.com, posted by Jerkstore on Wednesday, January 21st, 2009 at 11:21 p.m. In my opinion, Tina Fey completely ruined SNL. The only reason she's celebrated is because she's a woman and an outspoken liberal. She has not a single funny bone in her body. Dear Jerkstore, huzzah for the truth teller. Women in this country have been over-celebrated for too long. Just last night there was a story on my local news about a missing girl, and they must have dedicated 7 or 8 minutes to where she was last seen and how she might have been abducted by a close family friend. And I thought, what is this, the news for chicks? Then there was some story about Hillary Clinton flying to some country because she's Secretary of State. Why do we keep talking about these dum-dums? We are a society that constantly celebrates no one but women, and it must stop. I want to hear what the men of the world have been up to. What fun new guns have they invented? What are they raping these days? What's Michael Bay's next film going to be? When I first set out to ruin SNL, I didn't think anyone would notice, but I persevered because, like you trying to do a 9-piece jigsaw puzzle, it was a labor of love. I'm not one to toot my own horn, but I feel safe with you, Jerkstore, so I'll say it. Everything you ever hated on SNL was by me, and anything you ever liked was by someone else who did it against my will. Sincerely, Tina Fey. P.S. You know who does have a funny bone in her body? Your mom, every night for a dollar. This letter is from a bodybuilding forum posted by Smarter Child on February 24th, 2008 at 2:10 p.m. I'd stick it in her tailpipe. Dear Smarter Child, thank you so much for your interest. Whether you meant it in a sexual way or merely as an act of aggression, I am grateful. As a woman of a certain age in this business, I feel incredibly lucky to still be catching your eye with my anus. You keep me relevant. Sincerely, Ms. T. Fay. From TMZ.com, posted by Kevin214 on November 9th, 2008 at 11:38 a.m. Tina Fey cheated. Anyone who has ever seen an old picture of her can see she has had 100% plastic surgery. Her whole face is different. She was ugly then, and she is ugly now. She only wished she could ever be as beautiful as Sarah Palin. Dear Kevin214, what can I say? You have an amazing eye. I guess I got caught up in the whole Hollywood thing. I thought I could change 100% of my facial features, and as long as I stayed ugly, no one would notice. How foolish I was. So let's wipe the slate clean. Full disclosure, here's a list of the procedures I've had done. Eye browning, nose lengthening. I get my teeth lightly hennaed each month to give them their amber luster. I've had my lips thinned, and I've had a treatment called grimage, where two fishing wires are run through my jawline and used to gather the skin until it looks like a fancy pillow. I've had sebaceous implants, small balls of Restylane placed in random locations to give the appearance of youthful neck acne. I don't have Botox. Unfortunately, I'm allergic. Instead, I have monthly injections of bromodiolone, a farm-strength rat poison. This keeps my face in a constant state of irritation and paralysis, which, of course, is indistinguishable from sexual excitement. My face is longer and thinner than it was 20 years ago, and while some might say that this is a natural effect of weight loss and aging, you and I know the truth. I pay a woman to sit on the side of my head twice a week. Madonna and Gwyneth go to her, and we've all had amazing results. Ugh, listen to me. I really have changed. Why did I feel the need to name-drop the fact that I'm friends with Madonna Vickerson and Gwyneth Chung? Well, Kevin214, since you're so savvy at spotting plastic surgery, I'm sure you've noticed some of my other famous friends who have had work done. Bishop Desmond Tutu, cheek implants. Supreme Court Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg, major tit job. And SpongeBob SquarePants, gender reassignment. Keep on helping me keep it real. T. 30 Rock, an experiment to confuse your grandparents. If you had told me when I was a kid that I would grow up to sit through the annual NBC employee sexual harassment seminar 14 times, I would have said, "What's sexual harassment?" Because Clarence Thomas didn't invent that until the early 90s. But I would have been very excited to hear that I would spend a large chunk of my adult life working for the Peacock. I love working at NBC. How could I not? I grew up watching Seinfeld, Johnny Carson, Late Night with David Letterman, and reruns of The Mothers-in-Law. When I was in my eighth season at Saturday Night Live, it was time to figure out what the next phase of my life would be. SNL is like high school, but at least in high school, they tell you when to graduate. It's harder to push yourself out of the nest. Lauren suggested I make a development deal with NBC and try to come up with a sitcom. A development deal means they pay you while you're thinking, which is a pretty great deal, unless you're like me and you feel constant anxiety that you haven't thought of anything yet. My ability to turn good news into anxiety is rivaled only by my ability to turn anxiety into chin acne. After a few months of getting money for nothing, I pitched NBC President of Primetime Development, Kevin Riley, an idea about a cable news producer, me, presumably, who was forced to produce the show of a blowhard right-wing pundit, Alec Baldwin, if we could ever get him, to boost her network's sagging ratings. Kevin Riley said, "No, thank you." All of a sudden, this development deal thing didn't seem so bad. If I could get turned down one or two more times, I could keep the development money and never have to make a show. But then I'd probably also never work again, and I have a very competitive and obedient nature, so chin acne and rewrites. Kevin Riley suggested for my next idea that I write something closer to my life. Why not write about what it's like to work at SNL? I was reluctant because it seemed self-indulgent to write about the show directly. I had really liked the cable news pitch because I liked the idea of writing Alec Baldwin as a powerful conservative, having him articulate passionately the opposite of everything he believes in real life. My husband, always more clear-headed about these things, suggested that I just keep Alec's character the same. And then I started thinking that if it was a show business story, I could use Tracy Morgan, too. A triangle between me, Alec Baldwin, and Tracy Morgan felt like it had potential. These three characters would have completely different views about any topic that came up. race, gender, politics, workplace ethics, money, sex, women's basketball, and they would agree and disagree in endless combinations. By 2005, I had fleshed out the idea that Kevin Riley requested. I would play the head writer of a late-night comedy show, Tracy Morgan would play a lunatic comedy star, and Alec Baldwin would play my overbearing conservative boss. Well, it was written for Alec Baldwin, but none of us had the balls to talk to him about it yet. I wrote what they call a pilot, which means you write the first episode of what you hope will be a long series. Pilot scripts are particularly difficult to write because you have to introduce all the characters without it feeling like a series of introductions. You have to tell a story that's not only funny and compelling, but also dramatizes your main character's point of view and what the series would be about thematically. Love, work, investigating sexy child murders in Miami, etc. If you want to see a great pilot, watch the first episode of Cheers. It's charming, funny, and well-constructed. If you want to see an awkward, sweaty pilot episode, watch 30 Rock. I will not be joining you because I never want to watch that mess again. The 30 Rock writing staff have asked me to stop saying that the pilot was terrible, so from here on out, I will refer to it as quirky and unique. I met with several excellent actors about playing the role of Jack Donaghy, and with each meeting, it became increasingly clear that the part was meant for Alec Baldwin. But I didn't have to work up the nerve to talk to him about it yet, because now I was pregnant, and the shooting of the pilot was postponed. In September, my daughter was born. For the record, epidural, vaginal delivery, did not poop on the table. Around Christmas time, I was back to work at SNL, and Alec was hosting. The show was good that week, and Alec was having a good time. Lorne and I looked at each other. Should we just ask him? Lorne asked him, and Alec said yes. I stayed out of the room, which is my specialty. An auspicious beginning. NBC executives must have seen something of value in my quirky and unique pilot, Alec Baldwin, because they decided for some reason, Alec Baldwin, to pick it up. This means they agreed to make 11 more episodes and maybe show them on TV. The announcement of which shows are picked up each year takes place in May at an advertisers' convention called the Upfronts. Ad buyers from all kinds of companies gather in New York City for a week. Each day, one of the networks presents its new fall lineup of shows. They rent out Radio City Music Hall or the Hilton Ballroom and try to dazzle the advertisers with exciting clips and personal appearances from their biggest stars. They talk about which target demographics they reach and how many upscale viewers they have. It is sexy, like having lunch with your parents after a medical exam sexy. The advertisers then decide where they want to spend their ad money, and the networks know how much money they'll have to work with in the fall. We have now exceeded my understanding of the television business. Right before the 2006 upfronts, I was called into Lorne Michaels' office at 2 in the morning after an SNL show. This is it, I thought. They've come to tell us they want the show. I don't know why I was so confident they would. Alec Baldwin? I had mixed feelings about this. I now had an 8-month-old at home, and I wasn't sure that this new 70-hour-a-week job was, as disgraced politicians say, in the best interests of my family at this current juncture at the present time. I was a little excited, but mostly blorfed. Blorfed is an adjective I just made up that means completely overwhelmed, but proceeding as if everything is fine and reacting to the stress with the torpor of a possum. I have been blorfed every day for the past 7 years. I went into Lorne's office to receive my good news, but something was up. The CEO of NBC Universal Television Group, Jeff Zucker, was there, and he seemed agitated. Apparently, with all my business savvy, I hadn't realized that Alec Baldwin had not signed up for any episodes beyond the pilot. NBC wanted Alec to sign a new contract before any announcements were made, but Alec, being one of the all-time great Irish ballbusters, would not be rushed. Alec and I like to joke now about what I call his Irish negotiating techniques, which usually boils down to his saying, "They offered me more money and I told them to go fuck themselves." So Mr. Zucker was being forced to order a show that did not actually have its star in place. He paced around the room. Lorne calmly assured him it would all work out. Alec would eventually sign his contract. Then Lorne waved his hand in front of Zucker's face and said, "These are not the droids you're looking for." He didn't, but he might as well have. "We're really going out on a limb for you here," Jeff Zucker said, wagging his finger at me begrudgingly. "Ugh, you're picked up." And then, in a most unfortunate Freudian slip, I said, "You're welcome," instead of "thank you." And that was the glorious beginning of what would go on to become the 102nd most popular show on television. Not the 102nd most popular television show of all time, the 102nd most popular television show of 2006. Assembling a team of ragtag assassins. Alec did eventually sign his contract, and we started production that August. My friend and former SNL co-worker Robert Carlock had moved with his wife and baby from California to New York to be an executive producer and co-head writer on the show. We surrounded ourselves with hardworking, funny people. Okay, sidebar. My bossy pants managerial techniques? I'll admit that as a female producer, I have a tacit no hotheads policy. For years, to be considered a genius at comedy, people had to be dangerous and unpredictable, and I have met some very dangerous, erratic, funny people over the years. People I admire, but I don't want to work with them every day. Go do your own show, tough guys, and I will gladly watch it from the safety of my home. I hire the most talented of the people who are the least likely to throw a punch in the workplace. If this is contributing to the demasculinization of America, I say, hold a telethon and let me know how it goes. I don't ever want to get punched in the face over a joke. Or even screamed at. These were those gentle people. Jack Burdett, a TV veteran who had worked on every show from Mad About You to Frasier to DAG. A handsome, soft-spoken Gary Cooper type, Jack didn't say a word for the first 4 weeks. When he finally spoke, it was during a mundane conversation in the writer's room about crappy summer jobs we'd had as teenagers. Jack laughed as he told how at 18 he was operating the roller coaster at Magic Mountain and how one night there was a riot in the park after a disco concert and 6 people got stabbed. One guy went down in front of him. And management decided the best way to control the situation was to lock everyone in the park. Then he turned in a thoughtful and hilarious 30 Rock script that showed he was more than just a former carny who had watched a man die. A couple months later, he spoke again to tell us how he had once bought a bunch of depth charges and thrown them off the side of a rowboat in Mexico. Also, he believes his torn ACL was healed by a visit to Roswell, and he once fainted in front of Ringo Starr from an undiagnosed testicle infection. Jack's stories were reason enough to keep him around. His elegant scripts were just a bonus. MVP episode 204, Rosemary's Baby. MVP joke, this piece of Jack Donaghy wisdom. Never go with a hippie to a second location. Kay Cannon was a woman I'd known from the Chicago improv world, a beautiful, strong, Midwestern gal who had played lots of sports and run track in college. Kay had submitted a good writing sample, but I was more impressed by her athlete's approach to the world. She had a can-do attitude, a willingness to learn through practice, and she was comfortable being coached. Her success at the show is a testament to why all parents should make their daughters pursue team sports instead of pageants. Not that Kay couldn't win a beauty pageant. She could, as long as for the talent competition, she could sing a karaoke version of Redneck Woman while shooting a Nerf rifle. MVP joke, Tracy Jordan admonishing a pigeon for eating out of the garbage. Stop eating people's old french fries, little pigeon. Have some self-respect. Don't you know you could fly? Dave Finkel and Brett Baer were a writing team from L.A., and I'm proud to say that during that first year, they contributed some of our weirdest material. MVP episode 118, Fireworks, in which Tracy finds out he is a descendant of Thomas Jefferson. MVP scene, Tracy, anxious over this change in his racial identity, dreams that he is on a paternity test episode of the Maury Povich Show with Thomas Jefferson. Played for dream logic and financial reasons by Alec Baldwin. You might want to check out the awesome screen grab in your PDF. Let's see, who else was there? Matt Hubbard, a baby-faced Harvard boy who always wanted to order McDonald's for staff lunch, which I liked a lot. Matt and his wife sublet a place on the Upper East Side of Manhattan that turned out to have bed bugs. This kind of deep human suffering in combination with his highly processed diet transformed him into a joke-writing superhero. MVP episode 115, Hardball. MVP joke, Tracy Jordan on food.
I love this cornbread so much, I want to take it out behind the middle school and get it pregnant.
There was Daisy Gardner, a delicate soul with a nervous stomach, who pitched some of the filthiest jokes you could imagine in the gentlest voice you could imagine. MVP episode 116, The Source Awards, in which Jack Donaghy tries to recover from the failure of his foul-tasting wine, Donaghy Estates, by trying to market it to the hip-hop community as a replacement for Cristal. MVP joke? Rapper Ghostface Killa saying, "My tummy hurts after trying to swig Donaghy Estates during a music video." The Lord sent me John Rigi, who upon first meeting looked like an angry longshoreman in a denim jacket and a skull cap, but turned out to be a sensitive Italian boy from Cincinnati and an excellent cook. MVP episode 104, Blind Date. MVP joke? Why did you think I was a lesbian? Your shoes. Well, I'm straight. Those shoes are definitely bi-curious. Our youngest writer was Donald Glover. He had just graduated from NYU's writing program and was still living in a dorm and working as an RA. Donald was our only African-American writer at the time, but his real diversity was that he was our only cool young person who could tell us what the kids were listening to these days. Also, because he came from a large family in Georgia, he was very helpful in writing for the character of Kenneth the Page. MVP joke, a scene where Jenna, Jane Krakowski, is trying to teach Kenneth, Jack McBrayer, how to brag about himself in a passive-aggressive way. What's a backdoor brag? It's sneaking something wonderful about yourself into everyday conversation, like when I tell people, it's hard for me to watch American Idol because I have perfect pitch. Oh, ew. Now you try. It's hard for me to watch American Idol because there's a water bug on my channel changer. It's hard for me to pinpoint what it is that I like most about that joke. Is it that Kenneth is truly incapable of bragging? The revelation that Kenneth's apartment is crawling with water bugs? No, I think it's the use of the grandmotherly expression, channel changer. As for Robert Carlock, his strengths are erudite references, absurd joke constructions, and white male malaise in a multicultural world. MVP episodes 105, Jactor, 215, Sandwich Day, 310, Generalissimo, 416, Apollo. MVP joke, too many to name. But the character that flows from him the most freely is Dr. Leo Spichemin, played by Chris Parnell. At the end of season one, Jack suffers a heart attack. His unscrupulous showbiz doctor comes out to the waiting room to give Liz, Jack's mother, Elaine Stritch, and Jack's fiancée, Emily Mortimer, a prognosis. Dr. Spichemin enters from ICU. His lab coat is covered in blood. The women all gasp. What, this? Huh, no, no. I was at a costume party earlier this evening, and the hostess's dog attacked me, so I had to stab it. Perhaps the Carlockian worldview is best summed up by this exchange from a recent episode when Tracy arrives at the hospital just after the birth of his daughter. Why is that baby covered in goop? Because everything about this is disgusting. Taking the world by storm. Storm downgraded to light rain by weather experts. We premiered on Wednesday, October 11th, 2006 at 8 p.m., and we were an instant hit, like figs for dessert or taking your guitar out at a party. We were new Coke. We were not a hit. But we barreled ahead, knowing that at least we'd come out of this with DVDs to show our friends. The story ideas came fast and furious in the beginning. What if Tracy went off his medication and started hallucinating a little blue dude everywhere? Sure. What if Jenna was in a movie called The Rural Juror and no one could understand her when she said the title? Fine. What if we do a story about Liz being called a cunt? Why wouldn't we? That had happened to me plenty. Actually, that had only happened to me once that I knew about. A coworker at SNL dropped an angry C-bomb on me, and I had the weirdest reaction. To my surprise, I blurted, "No, you don't get to call me that. My parents love me. I'm not some adult child of an alcoholic that's going to take that shit." And it never happened again, that I know of. You know that saying, dance as if no one is watching? Well, that's what we were doing. We were dancing with abandon and no one was watching. Actually, about 5.5 million people were watching, but that counts as nothing. In my Chicago theater days, the rule was there had to be more people in the audience than on the stage or we canceled the show. So 5 million people seemed pretty good to me. But back when Friends was in its prime, they had about 25 million viewers. We were in jeopardy. I don't think Robert Carlock unpacked his suitcase that whole first year. He probably didn't even buy full gallons of milk, assuming we'd be canceled any minute and he'd have to chug the whole thing and get back on the plane to Los Angeles. I proceeded with the blithe confidence of a moron. I was the baby in Baby's Day Out, toddling down the street completely unaware that an anvil had just fallen behind me. Although good news gives me angina, I am impervious to bad news. I should be in one of those Oliver Sacks books because surely I have a rare head injury. Conversely, every time the office phone rang, Robert put his coat on. That was the burden of his higher intelligence. We worked incredibly hard that first year and every year since. Carlock and I can't believe that we used to complain about the hours at SNL, which now seems like a cakewalk. Especially for me, because that's all I did my first 2 years at SNL, was walk around and look for cake. For context, please look at the chart in your PDF that shows the relative stress levels of various jobs. Jeff Zucker and Kevin Reilly proved to be real champions of the show. We started making jokes about NBC and its then parent company GE almost immediately. We didn't have anything against GE or even really know anything about GE, but we had painted ourselves into a corner by making it Jack Donaghy's workplace in the show. When Carlock got a call one day from a woman in the GE legal department disputing the accuracy of a GE mention in one of our scripts, we were confused and nervous. Why does the parent company have our scripts? Is this going to happen every week? Don't they know I'm the baby from Baby's Day Out? Apparently, it was Mr. Zucker who personally intervened and explained to his more corporate peers that these were just jokes and we were to be left alone. Maybe he assumed we'd be dead soon. Whatever the reason, I appreciate NBC for letting us make jokes about them all the time. I don't think ABC or CBS would stand for that abuse, and I'll probably never find out. Doing, learning, dying. We shoot 30 Rock on film like a little movie each week. This means that we film every line of dialogue about 5 times from about 5 different angles. Every time we switch angles, it takes about 20 minutes to move the cameras around. Every 5 minutes, the cameras run out of film and we have to reload. If someone's getting on our fake elevator in a scene, it usually takes an extra 5 tries to have the elevator door close at the right time. You don't even want to know what happens if there's a dog, cat, parrot, baby, or peacock in the shot. And worst of all, our cast and crew like one another and enjoy lively conversations. All this jocularity adds up to about 14 hours a day. If we shot on this newfangled high-def video, it would go faster, but we would look like the zombie backup dancers in Thriller. We only shoot in this single-camera style because it's currently the fashion. Classic shows like Frasier and Everybody Loves Raymond and Seinfeld were shot multi-camera in front of an audience. I'm pretty sure it took about 3 hours a week. I don't know why the network's taste changed to single-camera shows, but there's no bucking fashion trends. If that were possible, I'd still be wearing this amazing pair of light blue jeans I owned in college that had 4 built-in belts across the front. That first season, when we shot on location in Manhattan, people would stop and watch, and then, realizing we were not Sex and the City, they would immediately leave. I learned a lot about acting that year. What I learned about film acting is that it's mostly about not standing in other people's light and remembering what hand you had your papers in. And when you do your off-camera lines for someone, you try to put your head real close to the camera. That's about it. You're a trained film actor now. Anything I learned about real acting, I learned from watching Alec Baldwin. By real acting, I mean an imitation of human behavior that is both emotionally natural and mechanically precise enough as to elicit tears or laughter from humans. Alec is a master of both film acting and real acting. He can play the emotion at the core of a scene. He is falling in love. His mother is torturing him. His mentor has been reincarnated as a peacock. While reciting long speeches word for word and hitting all the jokes in the right rhythm. You would be surprised how many major, Oscar-winning movie stars cannot do this. There are only about 9 people in the world who can do this. Maybe 3 more that we don't know about in North Korea. Alec knows to let the camera come to him. He can convey a lot with a small movement of his eyes. He speaks so quietly sometimes that I can barely hear him when I'm standing next to him. But when you watch the film back, it's all there. It may not have made me a better actor, but at least now I know why what I'm doing is terrible. After each 14-hour acting class was over, I would meet up with 5 or 6 writers at my apartment to catch up on what they had written during the day. During that first year, we'd order food and work until 1 or 2 in the morning. My husband Jeff sat in what was meant to be a pantry and wrote music to score the show. We kept a video baby monitor next to the computer screen, and I could watch my daughter sleeping while we worked. I would excuse myself occasionally to change a diaper in the night, usually for the baby. These will definitely be my happiest memories of this time because everything I cared about was within 10 feet of me. One night, I put my daughter to bed, worked with the writers all night, and in the morning when she toddled out, the writers were still there. It was the best, worst thing ever. Another night to remember, around 3 a.m., Carlock and I were leading a rewrite in my living room and realized that we had both fallen asleep while talking. When we woke up a few moments or hours later, The other writers were just sitting politely, awaiting further instruction. That is a dedicated staff. The only downside was that the next day's work began at 6 a.m. In spite of the exhaustion, I am proud to say, I lost my cool only once in my kitchen.
"It's too much. It's just too much work,"
I sobbed to my husband. "Please refer to the coal mining and military service sections of Chart A for perspective." I turned to domestic violence only once. We were going to bed at 3 a.m., knowing that we'd have to get back up at 5:30 a.m., and my husband kept talking and talking as a joke when I was trying to fall asleep. His exhaustion had given him the giggles, and he kept poking me and waking me up, saying things like, "Hey, I gotta ask you one more thing. Do you like pretzels?" I flew off my pillow and shoved him so hard across the bed that I saw genuine fear flash across his face. It was one of the very few deleted scenes from Star 80 in my life. There is one other embarrassing secret I must reveal, something I have never admitted to anyone. Though we are grateful for the affection 30 Rock has received from critics and hipsters, we were actually trying to make a hit show. We weren't trying to make a low-rated critical darling that snarled in the face of conventionality. We were trying to make Home Improvement, and we did it wrong. You know those scientists who were developing a blood pressure medicine and they accidentally invented Viagra? We were trying to make Viagra, and we ended up with blood pressure medicine. No matter how many times we tried to course-correct the show to make it more accessible, slow the dialogue down, tell fewer stories per episode, stop putting people in blackface, the show would end up careening off the rails again. In my limited experience, shows are like children. You can teach them manners and dress them up in little sailor suits, but in the end, they're going to be who they're going to be. By episode 11, 30 Rock had really found its voice, and it was the voice of a crazy person. The episode ended up being called Black Tie, but while we were shooting it, we referred to it as Goodbye, America. We were coming to the end of our initial order, and there was no sign of our being picked up again. The other reason we were calling it Goodbye, America was because this episode was nuts. If we had any concern that the show was too weird to succeed, we certainly weren't helping ourselves with this one. The main story of the episode is that Alec's character, Jack Donaghy, attends a birthday party for his friend, an inbred Austrian prince named Gerhard Habsburg. Gerhard Habsburg was played by Paul Rubens, the genius known to most as Pee-wee Herman. Paul committed deeply to his role. He chose to wear fake teeth and pale makeup, and he had one tiny ivory hand. Years before Kristen Wiig's tiny hand on SNL, our writers would want me to point that out. In case you're wondering if 30 Rock would ever be a commercial hit, look at the picture of Gerhard Habsburg in your PDF. In the story, Jenna, Jane Krakowski, is determined to Grace Kelly herself by meeting and marrying Gerhard and becoming a princess. This culminates in a long scene where she dances for the prince. Jane danced, like no one was watching, as Paul improvised, calling out different dance styles. Jazz, tap, jitterbug, Charleston, interpretive. Twirl, twirl again, keep twirling. After he professes his love for Jenna and she reciprocates, Gerhard takes a sip of celebratory champagne, knowing that it will kill him because his malformed body cannot metabolize grapes. He dies immediately. This was our best attempt at writing a sitcom. Poor Gerhard serves as a metaphor for the show itself. Strange, but not stupid. Desperate to be loved, but abhorrent to most. A proud member of an aristocracy that no longer existed, network television. Some unsolicited theories about television. Gerhard's picture leads me to something else I'd like to acknowledge, which is what a human-looking cast we are. Sure, Alec has a movie star face and Jane is leggy and blonde, but the cumulative age of our series regulars is 210, and even the African-Americans among us are pretty pasty. I personally like a cast with a lot of different shaped faces and weird little bodies and a diverse array of weak chins because it helps me tell the characters apart. When actors are too good looking, I can't memorize them. For example, I have never seen a picture of Sienna Miller where I didn't say, "That girl's pretty, who is that?" For years, the networks have tried to recreate the success of Friends by making pilot after pilot about beautiful 20-somethings living together in New York. Beautiful 20-somethings living in Los Angeles. Beautiful 20-somethings investigating sexy child murders in Miami. This template never works because executives refuse to realize that Friends was the exception, not the rule. The stars of beloved shows like Cheers, Frasier, Seinfeld, Newhart, and The Dick Van Dyke Show had normal human faces. And that's what some of the people on our show have. When you watched Sanford and Son, you didn't want to have sex with everybody you saw, just Grady. I've never understood why every character being hot was necessary for enjoying a TV show. It's the same reason I don't get Hooters. Why do we need to enjoy chicken wings and boobies at the same time? Yes, they are a natural and beautiful part of the human experience, and so are boobies. But why at the same time? Going to the bathroom is part of life, but we wouldn't go to a restaurant that had toilets for seats. Or would we? Excuse me while I call my business manager.
Oh, yeah, hi. I just have a quick question. But I have a good idea. I really have it. And I was just wondering if that would work out for them. No? No? Really? Okay. Japan? Really? Okay. All right. Thanks. Bye.
Nah. He said it's a non-starter. They already have that in Japan. The week after Goodbye America, we shot episode 12, which was called The Baby Show. It was officially the last show of our order. Members of our crew were calling around looking for their next job. On set, people started eyeing the furniture, wondering what it would go for in the cancellation fire sale. Don Fay happened to be visiting the set that last week when Kevin Reilly called to say that we were picked up for the rest of the season. I may never know why they chose to keep the show going, Alec Baldwin, but my proudest moment as an adult was walking back onto the soundstage in front of my dad and telling everyone they still had jobs. My proudest moment as a child was the time I beat my Uncle Pierre at Scrabble with the seven-letter word, farting. By March, the first season of 30 Rock was complete. For the record, no epidural, group vaginal delivery, did not poop the table. That September, we won the Emmy for Outstanding Comedy Series. Now, I'm not saying anything that hasn't been said hundreds of times, but 30 Rock is the perfect symbol for the pro-life movement in America. Here's this little show that no one thought would make it. I'm sure NBC considered getting rid of it, but by the time we won the Emmy, they were too far along. As the mother of this now five-year-old show, would I still rather have a big, strong, two-and-a-half men than our sickly little program? No, I would not, because I love my weird little show. I think this show was put on Earth to teach me patience and compassion. The days are long and the years are short, stay-at-home moms and sex workers. Now that we have finished season five, I cannot believe this, but it is time to start shopping for parachutes again. Rob Reiner was a guest on the show this year, and he went out of his way to tell us all to appreciate this job. Jobs like this are special, and they don't last forever. No need to remind me, Michael Stivic. I am always grateful. Here are answers to some frequently asked questions about 30 Rock. Question, is Alec Baldwin really leaving show business? Answer, I don't know, but we do have a contingency plan. A slightly out-of-focus Billy Baldwin. Question, is Tracy Morgan as wild and crazy as his character? Answer, there's only one way for you to find out. Drive across country with him in a Prius. Question, will Jack and Liz ever hook up? Answer, in spite of their Sam and Diane sparring, their relationship will remain more like Norm and Cliff, making out while drunk and then denying it. Question, when is it on again? Answer, it's Thursdays at 10 or sometimes 8:30, unless we're, you know what? Just DVR it, and you have to add an extra minute at the end to get the whole thing. Okay, bye. Question, where did you find Grizzen.com? Answer, Grizzen.com were born adorable and fully clothed and found nestled in a field. They were the inspiration for the Cabbage Patch Dolls and the Cabbage Patch Dance. Question, when are we going to see more of Pete and the writers? Answer, season 9. Question, has Tracy Morgan ever French kissed an NBC executive? Answer, yes, but only at an official NBC event and only against her will. Question, is Jack McBrayer really like his character? Answer, no. Jack's character is a simple farm boy from Stone Mountain, Georgia. Jack himself would be useless on a farm, and he's from the bank robbery and teen sex scandal metropolis of Conyers, Georgia. Question, how come Liz Lemon talks so much about food and overeating, but she's not fat? Answer, the character Liz Lemon has a rare condition called orophasmia, where everything she eats immediately falls out her bottom like a ghost. This was established in episode 219, the one about Liz's orophasmia, in the roller coaster scene with Emmy-nominated guest star Marissa Tomei. Question. Is 30 Rock the most racist show on television? Answer. No. In my opinion, it's NFL football. Why do they portray all those guys as murderers and rapists? Question. How many janitors work at TGS, the fictional show within the show? Answer.